beat her I don't know how long. And after a while, she began to pray and ask God to have mercy on those people. And it wasn't too long before three white men came to my cell. One of these men was a state highway patrolman. And he asked me where I was from. And I told him Roseville. He said, we're going to check this. And they left my cell, and it wasn't too long before they came back. He said, you are from Roseville, all right. And he used the curse word. And he said, we're going to make you wish you was dead. I was carried out of that cell into another cell where they had two Negro prisoners. The state highway patrolman ordered the first Negro to take the blackjack. The first Negro prisoner ordered me, by orders from the state highway patrolman, for me to lay down on a bunk bed on my face. And I laid on my face. The first Negro began to beat. And I was beat by the first Negro until he was exhausted. I was holding my hands behind me at that time on the left side because I suffered from polio when I was 6 years old. After the first Negro had beat until he was exhausted, the state highway patrolman ordered the second Negro to take the blackjack. The second Negro began to beat, and I began to work my feet. And the state highway patrolman ordered the first Negro had beat to sit on my feet, to keep me from working my feet. I began to scream, and one white man got up and began to beat me in my head and tell me to hush. One white man, my dress had worked up high. He walked over and pulled my dress. I pulled my dress down, and he pulled my dress back up. I was in jail when Matthew Evers was murdered. All of this is on account of we want to register to become first-class citizens. And if the Freedom Democratic Party is not seated now, I question America. Is this America, the land of the free and the home of the brave, where we have to sleep with our telephones off of the hook, because our lives be threatened daily, because we want to live as decent human beings in America? Thank you.
That was Fannie Lou Hamer. Fannie Lou Hamer, the end of her speech that she gave at the Democratic National Convention in Atlantic City in 1964. And we remember her. We remembered her earlier in the week. And we thought it was important to talk about her life, what it meant then, but what it means now for 2014, all these years later, from 1964 to 2014, 50 years. Yeah. We have with us in the studio John Milton Wesley, who is an author, songwriter, senior fellow in social marketing with the National Center for Health Behavioral Change at Morgan State University. He is also the godson of Fannie Lou Hamer.
Yeah.
He grew up with Fannie Lou Hamer and has will contextualize this in a very personal way as well.
Yeah.
In the course of our conversation, we're joined by Dr. Peniel Joseph, who is professor of history at Tufts University, author of the award-winning Waiting Till the Midnight Hour, A Narrative History of Black Power in America, and Dark Days, Bright Nights, From Black Power to Barack Obama. And joins us here by phone. So, gentlemen, welcome. Good to have you both with us. His most recent book, obviously, is Stokely Alive, which we talked about on the air with him.
Yeah.
Welcome, both of you.
Thanks for having me.
And you all can join us here, 410-319-8888. Write to us here, talk@steinershow.org. You can also log on to our Facebook pages and make comments there. You can tweet me at Mark Steiner. 410-319-8888 is the number here. So that's a very powerful and stunning and stirring moment. And story that she told of this kind of the objects of such severe repression that she faced in Mississippi, and that you grew up with as a young boy in Mississippi.
Yeah, first, let me say hello to Brother Joseph. It's good to be on the air with you. There is so much of this experience when I come back to this day. August 28th, the day that Emmett's body washed up on the creek, Tallahatchie River. But also thinking back to that time, I want to go back to that week and that in that period. And I remember when Mrs. Hamer came home from that beating in Winona, and she couldn't walk. And she had problems with the polio. She walked with the limp, but she couldn't walk. And I remember taking food, over to her house. And as a little kid, the thing that struck me so much was that, I realize that I'm 13 or 14 years old, but the idea that some white man had gotten some black man to beat Mrs. Hamer, for my little head, it just,
and that's a direct lineage from what happened in slavery and in Reconstruction, the beginning of,
right.
There's a whole history of that. And Peniel Joseph, talk about that instance in terms of what it says to us here in 2014.
Yeah, no, I think, and it's great to be on the phone with you as well. I think that, Fannie Lou Hamer, who I've written about, and I when I lecture, I really, talk about her and what she meant. This is the personification of a move for black equality, because what Fannie Lou Hamer represents is the African-American experience from slavery to freedom, but also the self-determination of poor black people and poor black women specifically in terms of Ruleville, Mississippi, coordinating with the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee and SNCC and people like Stokely Carmichael and Bob Moses. But she became, the great thing about SNCC was that SNCC wasn't in it to be leaders and photo ops and things like that. Ella Baker was pursuing radical democracy and told them that they were fighting for more than just a hamburger. But that speech, I Question America, brilliant speech. She's a brilliant woman who's
yes.
not formally educated. So the thing about Fannie Lou Hamer, and I love that Stokely always recognized, Fannie Lou Hamer was an intellectual and an organizer, right? But I say intellectual first because that's what she was. She just was an intellectual from the Deep South and somebody who the system had decided was never going to amount to anything and who pushed back against that system, became an organizer, dies at 59, 1977, had given away all the money that she had raised for all these poor people in Mississippi, had tried to do a farm cooperative that didn't work out, had really put her life on the line for this thing we call radical democracy, meaning more than just one person, one vote, but she was interested in health care. She was interested in a decent income and living wage for black people, but all poor people. She's the person, one of the people who inspires King's movement for economic justice, because we focus on King, but it's people like Fannie Lou Hamer who are at the who's really a grassroots, organic intellectual and organizer. And I love that you mentioned the beating, because when we think about Ferguson in 2014, the fact that you could beat black women and children in 1964, it gives you a great example of what American democracy actually means on the ground for poor black people. They're beaten, they're violated, they're persecuted, they're demonized and defamed and humiliated, and that's what happened to Mrs. Hamer. But she transformed that humiliation into a state of grace by illustrating not just the deep contradictions of American democracy, but the hypocrisy of the way in which we all live 50 years ago. That speech is a transformative speech. It's a heroic speech, but it's a speech that in a granular way talks about the way in which black people were oppressed on a daily basis, but the way in which out of that oppression, they actually reimagined democracy in an expansive way, even for the people who were oppressing them. So that's her brilliance and her genius is saying that even though this is a sick, destructive society, we can change things.
Yeah, Peniel, and the interesting thing about that, I think that was so illustrative about that speech on a national scene. Keep in mind that this was 1964. This was 4 years before WLBT-TV in Jackson lost its license for discrimination against blacks. But it was roughly a year before Mega Evers had been shot after leaving WLBT-TV in Jackson to arrange to try to get more coverage on television for blacks.
It was a year after her speech.
That's what I'm saying. Year after. But I think the other thing to keep in mind is that the president of the United States used the media to deflect attention away from Mrs. Hamer's speech at the Democratic National Convention.
They did.
Well, yeah, he tried. That didn't work, though, because what's interesting is he broke it up live, but over the next 48 hours, people kept playing that speech
over and over again. Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, one of the things you just said, Peniel, I think is important, is that the comment you made before this, you closed with the thought that Fannie Lou Hamer believed in radical democracy and thought that and deeply believed we can change things. Mm-hmm. So that's why I'm curious how you all think that let's extrapolate that out to 2014. When I said earlier, before you came, both gentlemen came on in our hour before, because the half an hour before, because there's a rally and teaching here today on Fergus Hill on the campus of Morgan State University, and two of the professors who were organizing it were here, and I said that the election of Barack Obama in 2008 in some ways now has heightened this discussion about racism and race in America and the history of race in America, how it affects the entire society. And outside the black community now, there's a body of people who are beginning to kind of wake up and realize this is something much deeper here in America. So I wonder how we take that Fannie Lou Hamer spirit of 1964 and place it in 2014, Peniel.
Yeah, well, I think we're doing it. I mean, I think even before Ferguson, when you see what happened in the aftermath of Trayvon Martin, there are grassroots social justice movements happening all across the United States. They're happening in Boston, Chicago, St. Louis, Oakland, Los Angeles. I think what's not been happening is having a clearinghouse and sort of a headquarters and a national convergence all together. And I think that the way in which that has to happen, we have the resources, but you have to have the will. So you've got the NAACP. You've got people like Reverend Al Sharpton. I just was on his show yesterday. He's got a platform on MSNBC and a lot of goodwill in the black community. There are all the Dream Defenders in Chicago. And there's going to be differences of opinions. One of the things we have to remember is that the civil rights movement had roiling debates. You had not only Malcolm and Martin, but you had Fannie Lou Hamer had disagreements with Dr. King. You had Stokely Carmichael. You had Black Panthers, Whitney Young. But beyond those disagreements, they could agree on certain things. So things like voting rights, things like the Civil Rights Act. So what we need collectively right now is an agreement on three or four big things that we are going to push for. I mean, one of them has to be the ending of mass incarceration and the transformation of the criminal justice system. Another has to be connected to public school education and transforming these schools. And then a couple of other things have to be connected to the unemployment rate, not just in the black community, but among poor black teenagers, which is crazy in places like not just Washington, D.C., Chicago, big cities, but, you know, Jennings, Missouri, Ferguson, Missouri, these places where we normally don't think of. So unemployment's a big part of where we're going as well. So there has to be, and I think we're starting to see a conversation about black equality, and not just racial equality, not just multiculturalism and diversity, because black equality is the common denominator. It's the litmus test, whether you're thinking about LGBT rights, whether you're thinking about women's liberation, whether you're thinking about a poor people's movement. The treatment of black people in this country is the yardstick and the barometer and the thermometer of the health of our democracy.
You know, one of the things you said there about unemployment, let me just touch this for a minute. Folks, I do want you to join us here at 410-319-8888 and give us your ideas and thoughts. Write to me here at steinershow.org. Log on to Facebook pages. I'm about to check that. Tweet me at Mark Steiner, 410-319-8888. There was a study done by a Hopkins professor we talked about here about 2 weeks ago, and it was a study that followed a group of kids from kindergarten all the way until they were in their late 20s, early 30s. Here's one of the astounding things that they found. I mean, not shocking, but it was interesting what he found, was that high school young men and women who graduated high school but never went to college, that the employment rate among white working class kids in that group was four times higher than it was for African Americans, even if you were an electrician or a plumber or whatever else. I mean, that's some of the inequity I think you're talking about, Peniel. That I think there has to be a focus on changing that.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, one of the great things about what Mrs. Hamer was doing in Mississippi and what SNCC was doing in the Freedom Democratic Party, it was aimed at concrete demands and bread and butter issues. So, the New York Times had a great story yesterday about Ferguson and the way in which young black men are being arrested on warrants as low as $75 for traffic charges that then metastasize into thousands of dollars of fines, and how
right.
that's financing, you know, $2.6 million worth in terms of Ferguson. And this is happening in Jennings and all across. So these are the one of the things we don't understand right now, 43 million black people, only 10% in the country make $100,000 a year or more. So there's 90% of folks making under $100,000 a year or more and are living, as you get down the social economic ladder, in terrible conditions where they're being used and abused and demonized. Their lives are very, very filled with racial and political economic oppression. And even black elites in 2014 are often disconnected from that black experience and are often more willing to sort of demonize and say, pull yourself up by the bootstraps, than look at the way in which structures are preventing folks from escaping this system, right? So what we're seeing with Ferguson, because of the military-style response, because of the violence, the state-sanctioned violence, by the way, not the violence of some of the demonstrators, but the violence of the local Ferguson police, and certainly the violent death of Michael Brown, people are talking about this again. And you saw civil rights activists, journalists, different people go down there. They need deep political organizing of the kind that Fannie Lou Hamer was involved in at the MFDP and after. You know, Fannie Lou Hamer shut out the DNC in 64. By 68, she's right there, you know, as a delegate. So there's a way in which Ferguson can be transformed, but then our national politics have to be transformed, because we live in a contradictory age. We have a black president, but we're not talking about a war on poverty. We're not talking about the issue of black equality. We're not talking about big ideas that can tackle economic inequality. We're not talking about any of that, right? So we need a civil rights movement in our contemporary time period that actually can speak truth to power. Fannie Lou Hamer was unafraid of criticizing presidents. She was unafraid of criticizing LBJ. And it's her political courage that is the biggest testament to who she was.
Let me get a phone call in here and come right over to you.
Oh, sure. Go right ahead.
410-319-8888. Russ, you're on the air.
Greetings, Mark, to you and your guests. And
good morning.
Let me give some kudos to the young man that just spoke, because I couldn't agree with him more for the need of the coalescing of three or four major issues that we all can get behind. But, you know, my observations, Mark, is in looking at how we approach racism, we do it in these types of forums where we take a sane, rational, objective approach to an issue that we end up with the wrong yardstick, because we're dealing with a second component to the issue that is totally irrationally, wholly objectively, and rooted in strains of insanity. When it comes to me talking with my friends about progress, and I have white friends who always ask, well, do you think you've made progress? When you deal with the objective side of the issue, yes. I can go anywhere I want and take my wife for dinner. I can go to any theater or sit on any seat in the bus. But when it comes to the acceptance factor, one man looking at another man as a man, no, we are still issues. When we don't have enough humanity in us to recognize murder, whether it is black, white, or polka dot, then we haven't made any progress. Thanks again, Mark, for letting me vet, and good luck to you, my brother.
Thank you very much. Good to hear from you, Russ. John?
Well, you know, it's interesting listening to what Peniel said and this brother. And I think about something that Paul Fussell said in the book Class. And he said, never play the race card first. Okay. However, play the politics card first. So if I look at Ferguson, if we look at the demographics of Ferguson, first of all, if all of the people, African Americans, who are registered to vote in Ferguson, first of all, register and vote. we could change not only Ferguson, but St. Louis County. And I think that that's the piece to look at. But I also think, and one of the things that we can do, well, we can do things like read Peniel's book. Because if we look at what happened in Cambridge in 63, remember, if Bobby Kennedy said that it was Cambridge that had the most impact on his understanding of the movement. And, you know, he hugged John Lewis and said to Lewis, you know, John, I get it now. So I think there are examples, if we look at that, of things that we can do now. And I think they are lessons to be learned to be used in Ferguson.
Maybe we are, Peniel, on the cusp of something happening in this century, of an opening of a dialogue to change things in a fundamental way. I mean, it's hard to see it now because there is, as you said, no real united movement, but things are happening across America. And when I saw the poll that Pew put out that said that 33% of white Americans thought we had to deal with racism, thought this was that was deeply involved in what happened in Ferguson, that to me was a point of light.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think the Pew poll is you know, it shows us where we're at in certain ways in terms of race relations. I think civil rights activists have hurt themselves by not talking about the issue of black equality, by really conforming to this idea of racial denial in the United States, where people don't want to talk about race. Because even the notion of saying, let's not play the race card, I understand what people are saying, but there really is no race card. This country is founded on racial slavery. The only way we can get to the other side is by having a movement for black equality. If you had the end of institutional racism, there'd be no more Ferguson. Once you ended institutional racism, you'd still have to end economic inequality. But just by ending institutional racism, the way that looks is that black life conforms closely to how white folks are living vis-a-vis social economic indicators, both success and failure. So when you think about college graduation rates, when you think about access to mortgages and home loans, when you think about businesses, when you think about treatment before the criminal justice system, and then bread and butter issues like underemployment and unemployment. So if we just got those rates up, there'd be no racial achievement gap. There'd be no, you know, when you think about black folks and heart disease or black folks and certain kinds of cancers, medical research that doesn't focus on diseases that are quote-unquote black diseases, the lack of access to mental health care. 40% of black children in the United States live below the poverty line. 28% of black people live below the poverty line. These are all just national catastrophes, right? They don't matter because the country doesn't believe in black equality. The bigger shame is that 50 years after the Civil Rights Act, there's a bunch of black people who don't believe in black equality, right? So what I've been pushing, and I've been writing about this in The Root, at Tufts, we have a Center for the Study of Race and Democracy. We're having a national dialogue on Race Day September 15th at Tufts. I've been pushing black equality because that's what Dr. King was pushing. That's what Fannie Lou Hamer, Malcolm X were pushing. Now, from that black equality, do you get universal themes? Absolutely. That's why everybody has piggybacked on black folks' movement, because it's been at the cutting edge of movements to transform democracy, because we started out in terms of chattel slavery. There's a new book coming out called The Half Has Never Been Told by Ed Baptiste. Brilliant book about slavery and capitalism.
Oh, yes, right, right.
Which you should really check out. Walter Johnson's River of Dark Dreams is a brilliant book about slavery and capitalism. Craig Wilder has a book, Ebony and Ivy, brilliant book about slavery, capitalism, and higher education in the Ivy Leagues, and also the extirpation of Native Americans. So the truth of the matter is that we can never get beyond race until we confront race, and beyond even that generic rubric of race. It's always and always will be about black folks in America, because the cultural racism, the political racism, the economic racism and exploitation has been contoured around the lives of black folks and also their exploitation. Slavery reimagines global capitalism. That's the great part about the book, The Half Has Never Been Told, because in a chapter-by-chapter way, it connects you to cotton, it connects you to
right.
British credit, it connects you to New Orleans. And it connects you to the black bodies and lives that made all that come true. By 1861, the most millionaires in the United States were in Mississippi.
That's
so
right.
The South was not this feudal country. The South was hyper-capitalism that connected the North to markets in China, in England, and all throughout the globe. So we reinvented capitalism on the backs of black labor and black bodies, including women and children who were raped, who were strafed, who were exploited, who were degraded, who were buried in unmarked graves, people who never had birth certificates and death certificates, even going into the 1960s into the Mississippi Delta with people like Fannie Lou Hamer.
That's right.
The truth of the United States. And again, you're not gonna win the presidency telling the truth, right? So you need a social movement. You need a social movement, right, that forces presidents and forces senators and forces Congress, right, and forces the country to recognize this and to do something about it. That's why Dr. King had a Poor People's March, and he was before. The reason he's assassinated is because they don't want him to be in D.C. with Resurrection City and having that moral force and power,
yes,
to force the anti-poverty legislation and the redistribution of wealth, which we need in the country, to happen.
Peniel, you said a great deal there. Sounds, yeah. I wish we're about out of time.
Sure.
I think what you were describing is really important. I know the book, The Half's Never Been Told. We got an early copy of it, and I'm kind of going through it now, and I can't wait to interview, do an interview around that book. I think the stuff you all are putting out, these scholars coming up, such as yourself and others coming up right now, are re-examining and reevaluating and giving us an analysis of the origins of our society that are really critical to understanding where we can go.
Exactly.
To understand where we actually came from. That's the critical moment I was trying to get to here. A final word from you, John.
Well, I would say, I would also just, in addition, Dr. Gene Battle, who's also from Louisville, Mississippi, who a writer who was growing up when I was there, as a matter of fact, has a very interesting book on the involvement of cotton and that whole era that Peniel was talking about, mm-hmm, in terms of wealth in Mississippi. Yeah.
And I'm sorry, John, we didn't get a chance to finish letting you get to all your
That's
stories
okay.
about Rouville today, but we
That's
will come
okay.
back to that,
we'll
you know.
We'll do it again. We'll do it again.
This has been fascinating, and John Milton Wesley, it's always a pleasure to see you, my friend, in the
Good
studio.
Good to be with you. Good to be with you, too, Peniel. Thank you. Thank
hey,
you so
much. Thank you, brother.
I want to talk to you sometime of why Lorna had to talk to Stokely at the March for Freedom, okay?
Oh, no, Bob. I'd love to. Looking forward to it.
Okay, take care.
Peniel Joseph, okay. Thanks once again so much for joining us. Look forward to having you back soon.
Take care.
Bye-bye. So, folks, I'm glad you all could join us here for this conversation. We're going to take a brief break, and then we're going to explore the power of art in our society, what it can do to change things and change lives, and interpret what we see around us with some really fascinating people coming into our studio. So stay with us. Don't go away. We're going out of here with this hour with Tina Turner's Proud Mary, 1986. She receives a star on this day on the Hollywood Walk of Fame.